a conversation about police brutality that includes people with disabilities.
When we talk about police violence, we need to also talk about disabled Black people and the intersections of ableism and racism.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Monday, June 15th, we look at police violence against Black people with disabilities in the United States. Then the police shooting of Sean Monterosa and broader police violence towards the Latinx community. And Alabama Congresswoman Terry Sewell talks with us about the current uprising for racial justice and the racist history of Confederate monuments.
My emotions swing from frustration and anger to real jubilance to see another generation of Americans doing what our democracy allows us to do.
But first, the police killing of Rashard Brooks in Georgia and the deaths of Robert Fuller and Malcolm Harsh in California. What it means for the communities that are dealing with this firsthand. The uprising against police brutality and racism continued across the country this weekend, and protesters are showing no signs of letting up. And in California and Georgia, more high-profile incidents of potential brutality against Black men have emerged. First, we go to Atlanta, where Friday night, an Atlanta police officer shot and killed Rashard Brooks, a 27-year-old Black man who had been asleep in his car at a Wendy's drive-thru. According to the Georgia Bureau of Investigations, two officers began to handcuff Brooks after he failed a sobriety test. When Brooks resisted, an officer tried to use a taser on him, which Brooks took from the officer before running away. Security camera footage from the scene appears to show Brooks fired the taser in the direction of the officers but continued running. One of the officers, Garrett Rolfe, then shot Brooks three times, twice in the back. Here's L. Chris Stewart, an attorney for Brooks's family, speaking at a press conference over the weekend.
We see from the protesters, we see from the people in the streets of all races now, that people are sick of watching Black men murdered. The one thing that nobody can disagree with is that it shouldn't have happened. But it did because the value of African-American males' lives in the inner city or wherever doesn't mean too much to officers nowadays.
Rolfe, the officer who shot and killed Brooks, was fired by the Atlanta Police Department, and the other officer was placed on administrative duty. On Saturday, Police Chief Erica Shields resigned. And on Sunday, authorities ruled Brooks' death a homicide. Now to California, where in the city of Palmdale, the body of Robert Fuller, a 24-year-old Black man, was found hanging from a tree on Wednesday morning. The Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department initially ruled his death a suicide, but several of Fuller's family members and friends say they do not believe he had been suicidal and that his death may have been a lynching. Fuller's death comes just 2 weeks after Malcolm Harsh, a 38-year-old Black man, was found hanging from a tree in Victorville, California. Local law enforcement say they don't suspect foul play in Harsh's death, but in a statement to the Victorville Valley News, Harsh's family wrote, quote, "The explanation of suicide does not seem plausible. There are many ways to die, but considering the current racial tension, a Black man hanging himself from a tree definitely doesn't sit well with us right now." Listeners, we know these stories aren't easy to hear, especially at the frequency at which they're happening, but we need to talk about it, and we're going to do that today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway, how these cases fit into the nationwide racial justice uprising. Joining me now is Stephanie Stokes, a reporter for WABE in Atlanta. Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Cerise Castle, a reporter and producer for KCRW in Los Angeles. Cerise, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Stephanie, let's start with you. There have been several videos of the Rashard Brooks killing that have been made public. This is the Atlanta incident. How much did we learn from these videos as opposed to the information that's been put out by law enforcement so far?
So we now have surveillance video, cell phone video, body cam footage, dash cam footage. And if you put it all together, you know, I think that we are seeing a fuller picture of the incident. It started, the first descriptions described it as a struggle between the officers and Brooks. But what we now know is that the incident really lasted about, there were about more than 30 minutes where the interactions between the officers and Brooks were very low-key and pretty cordial, actually. He'd been asleep in the drive-thru at Wendy's when officers arrived, and they're chatting with him, asking him how much he's had to drink. Officials say he failed a sobriety test. At one point, he asks officers if he can just walk home, but the officer, Officer Rolf, says he's been having too much to drink, and that's when he begins to arrest him. And it's at that point that things really take a different turn, and things happen really fast. That's when the struggle does begin, and Brooks runs. He has a taser from the officer, and the officer follows him and shoots him.
Stephanie, you said things happen really fast, and I think one of the things that also happened really fast was the response, at least the initial response from to this killing. Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, before Brooks was killed, initially said she would not support cuts to the Atlanta Police Department budget. But since the killing, Atlanta's police chief, as we mentioned at the top, Erica Shields, has resigned, and the officer who killed Rashard has been fired. What do we know about whether or not Mayor Keisha Bottoms, is shifting her position on how she sees the police department in light of this killing?
Well, I think we're going to see that very soon. Right now, we are in the middle of the city council is considering the proposed budget, and there's actually a city council meeting today where I think we're going to hear a lot from people during public comment, and there is a listening session tomorrow. But yeah, like you said, right now the police budget is intact. The mayor has supported raises for police officers. There's been a big effort to make sure Atlanta police officers can live in the city of Atlanta, which is becoming increasingly unaffordable. So she's really made that an effort of her administration. Reducing the budget would be a change for her. And yeah, in regards to the speed, it is a big difference from past incidents of police shootings in Atlanta. Some have still not been resolved after a few years. So the fact that the police chief would resign within 24 hours and that we're seeing dash cam footage, these sort of details about the shooting come out so quickly, it's really a change.
Cerise, I want to bring you in here because there are two cases that we're looking at now in California. Initially, in the case of Robert Fuller, why was local law enforcement in Palmdale, California, so quick to rule Robert Fuller's death a suicide?
That's really the question that community members and Fuller's family are asking themselves. They haven't really offered an explanation as to why that suicide ruling was made. The mayor of Palmdale simply offered the explanation that when the sheriff's deputies come out and do their preliminary investigation, they write down what they see. And that's really all the news that we've had insofar as to why Fuller's death was labeled as a suicide.
Cerise, over the weekend, you've been covering this story and you tweeted that the area where Robert Fuller's body was found hanging from a tree, there had also been several recent high-profile incidents involving white supremacists. Can you tell us a little bit about those incidents?
Definitely. For those who don't know, the Antelope Valley is known in Southern California for really being a bastion for white supremacists. And this goes back for decades, going all the way back to redlining on housing policy in the 80s to as recently as 2016, that incident that you mentioned where three white men were charged with a hate crime after attacking a group of Latinx people in a park. This was also the day after a Ku Klux Klan rally was held not too far away from the area. And the Ku Klux Klan also has made their presence very known in Palmdale. I mean, just as recently as 2007, they were distributing leaflets and flyers in neighborhoods.
There are, horribly, there are two black men that have been found hanging from trees in California. The second black man that we're talking about today who died in this way is Malcolm Hirsch. Cerise, tell us about how the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department has been handling that case and whether it's similar to how the police department is handling Robert Fuller's death.
So initially, both of the law enforcement agencies were handling this death the same way. They ruled them as suicides and proceeded to move about as such. With Robert Fuller, the backlash from the community prompted local government to step in and actually part with the sheriff's department and say that they wanted a full investigation. That was a statement that came from the mayor of Palmdale. In San Bernardino, though, things are moving about business as usual. Malcolm Hirsch's death is still being looked at as a suicide. And insofar, they don't really have any plans to change that ruling as far as I'm aware. It's a little bit harder for the community to apply pressure as the Hirsch family is based in Ohio. Malcolm, as far as I know, was the only member of the family who's here in Southern California. So I think it's been a little bit harder for the family to get the traction from the community to draw attention to the case. But I know Malcolm's name is being lifted up high at every Robert Fuller rally and protest that I have attended. So the Antelope Valley is definitely advocating for Malcolm's death to be investigated as well.
Stephanie, to circle back with you in Atlanta, we mentioned how quickly the response was, at least at initially, with the chief of police, Erica Shields, stepping down and other steps being taken to address this. How much of that, Stephanie, has to do with the public pressure that we're seeing applied from protesters who have not let up now for going into a third week?
Oh, I think that is a really significant point. This does follow 2 weeks of demonstrations in Atlanta as well as around the country, and we've seen thousands of people come to the streets here. Those really felt like a response to these killings that we've seen nationally, the death of George Floyd, of course. But we have heard activists try to shine a light on some of the incidents that have happened in Atlanta and have been unresolved. And where officers have not been held accountable. But this case on Friday actually came while protests were starting to taper off here. I mean, there were still hundreds of people, but not the thousands we'd been seeing. And so this really reignited those protests. And I think protesters here have been trying to say, you know, Atlanta isn't special. The city likes to promote itself as the so-called city too busy to hate. It's the birthplace of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And the political and business leaders try to say it's a place where people of all races get along. And I think what I'm hearing from protesters is exhaustion, and also trying to point out that Atlanta needs to change too.
Stephanie Stokes is a reporter for WABE in Atlanta, and Cerise Castle is a reporter and producer for KCRW in Los Angeles. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
2 weeks ago, amid widespread protests against police brutality, police shot and killed 22-year-old Sean Monterosa, a man of Salvadorian and Argentinian descent, in Vallejo, California. Police say that they were trying to stop looters at a Walgreens and thought the hammer in Monterosa's pocket was a gun. Monterosa was kneeling with his hands up when an officer fired 5 shots through the windshield of his patrol cruiser.
No matter what, he's already surrendering. And the officer shot my brother through his vehicle, through the windshield. How more coward can you be, man?
That's his sister Ashley Monterosa speaking with NBC News. And Monterosa's killing isn't the only recent example of police violence against the Latino community. For more on how this fits in with the larger conversation about police brutality in the United States, we're joined now by Eric Ortiz, staff writer for NBC News, who focuses on racial injustice and social inequality. Eric, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tanzina. Thanks for having me on.
So we understand that Sean Monterosa was on his knees already in a position to surrender to police. And as we mentioned, police shot and killed him. Where does the case stand right now?
So right now, the city has asked for the Department of Justice and the State Attorney General, Xavier Becerra, to investigate the case. And that's a big deal. The city has not previously asked in other police-involved shootings or excessive force cases to have the state AG look into this. So the state has not said yet if they will, but the district attorney in Solano County is also looking at the case. And she has said that she, you know, is going to investigate it thoroughly. And if the state decides to take part in it as well, then she will allow that.
Let's talk a little bit about why the case has been escalated to that level. Is this the first time that the Vallejo Police Department has been scrutinized for its use of force?
It is not. So over the past decade, there have been no less than 18 fatal police shootings in Vallejo, and the vast majority have been Black and brown men. And that is significant in a city where the population is roughly 122,000 people, and it's evenly divided among Black, white, Asian, and Latino residents. And the census there says it's one of the most evenly split by race zip codes in the country. So even for its small size, there's been a sort of number of excessive force lawsuits and complaints of use of force, and the money paid out in settlements, and then the amount of fatal shootings, it's just completely high compared to a lot of other communities. So if you take a look at the per capita police shooting rate in Vallejo, it's about 13 per 100,000 residents. And in Oakland, that number is 9 per 100,000. In Los Angeles, it's about 4. So that just goes to show how big a problem it's been in this city.
Montrose's death, Eric, isn't receiving as much national media attention. Could partly be because there isn't a video to accompany the story right now, which I think is part of the reason why many of these cases are getting attention. But more broadly, I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit about the issue of police brutality, specifically within Latino and Latinx communities. We know here in New York, there have been historically, there have been some parallels with Black and brown communities being at the receiving end of police brutality. Is that more happening around the country right now?
Well, I mean, you can look at the federal data, and it shows that Blacks and Latinos have interactions with police at disproportionate rates compared with their populations. And there have been plenty of studies that, you know, show Latinos get pulled over at higher rates during traffic stops and are overrepresented in, you know, the juvenile and criminal justice system. So, you know, when you mention New York, you know, Latinos are also getting targeted under stop and frisk, as well as, you know, Black residents. And we've seen even more recently reports of Latinos getting higher numbers of summonses for violating social distancing rules. So it shouldn't be a shock to anyone that Latinos also face the same number of police brutality and excessive force complaints against officers. And you actually have the names of Latinos in recent years who've died at the hands of police, and they haven't gotten coverage. And, you know, when you say names like Anthony Nunez in San Jose and Melissa Ventura in Arizona, and then Jessica Hernandez, who was killed by Denver police back in 2015, I mean, her death resulted in changes to the city's use of force policy. So, you know, there are things that happen when these killings occur, and they might not be high profile, you know, nationally, but they can change things on the local level.
Eric, are we noticing any parallels, at least? I know in New York City over this weekend, the traditional Puerto Rican Day parade did not happen because of the pandemic. And instead, there were some Puerto Ricans who decided to gather and march for Black Lives Matter. There are many Latinos who themselves are also Black, and among them are Puerto Ricans. I'm wondering if you're seeing any coalition building between protesters who are talking about police brutality against Black Americans and protesters who are talking about police brutality against Latino and Latinx communities. Is there some sort of coalition building happening right now to address this more broadly?
Absolutely. I mean, look in Texas, in Austin, they've had protests there, and they're calling out the name of a man called Mike Ramos. And he was killed during a police altercation back in April. And, you know, this is one of those cases where police thought he might have had a gun in his car. And then the police chief there, Brian Manley, said that, you know, officers never actually recovered a gun. So now the Texas Rangers are investigating. So, and interestingly enough, Ramos was, he identified both as Latino and Black. So, you know, the deaths of people who are Afro-Latino add this other layer to this, you know, already really complex discussion about bias in policing. So the same way you might also have, you know, Hispanics who may be mistaken by police as white, or, you know, police decide not to disclose the race of the person who was killed at all. That just means that there could be an underreporting of the number of Latinos who are killed or injured. And that's why it's important for a lot of these activists to, you know, say, hey, like, we need to stand with our, you know, other Black activists, or we need to stand with Latino activists, because, you know, we're all in this together.
We'll be following this story as it develops. Eric Ortiz, staff writer for NBC News, who focuses on racial injustice and social inequality. Eric, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Across the country, cities and states are grappling with removing symbols of the American Confederacy and other markers of the United States' dark history of oppression. But in Alabama, change is happening more slowly. On June 1st, Alabama observed a state holiday celebrating the birthday of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy. It's one of three holidays celebrating the Confederacy in Alabama. Over the weekend, former U.S. Attorney General and current Senate candidate Jeff Sessions said a proposal to remove names of the Confederacy soldiers from U.S. military bases would, quote, betray the character and decency of those who fought to continue Southern slavery. But last week, Congresswoman Terry Sewell, the lone Democrat representing Alabama in Congress, took to social media to say it's time to stop celebrating the Confederacy. Sewell wrote, quote, we need atonement to heal. Sewell represents the 7th Congressional District of Alabama, which includes Selma, Birmingham, and Montgomery, which were key sites of the civil rights movement. And Representative Sewell joined me last week to talk about this moment, just as her state is also seeing a sharp uptick in coronavirus cases.
You know, I think that over the last few months, of course, I think we have to start by just saying COVID-19 has had a disproportionate effect on my constituents. I proudly represent my home district, which includes Birmingham, Montgomery, and my hometown of Selma, Alabama. The effects of COVID-19 were devastating enough, being that so many of my constituents are disproportionately affected as African Americans and at risk. And now, on top of the global health pandemic, we're in the middle of another pandemic. And as my constituents ask me often, and friends have been reaching out and asking me, how do I feel? You know, I have to say, I'm not doing well. It's very complicated, right? I think that I'm not okay. I'm not okay as I witness a reopening of Alabama's economy on Memorial Day, and sights of folks at the beaches without masks on, and a huge spike in our number of hospital beds, ICU beds. It's really frightening, and a huge spike in the number of cases is pretty frightening. And then, of course, I have to say, my emotions swing from frustration and anger to real jubilance to see another generation of Americans doing what our democracy allows us to do, and that's to grieve send our grievances and redress to our government and expect change. Protest is the highest form of civic engagement. And I just hope that during this moment, we who are in positions of power are listening, and that we are willing to change.
We are seeing protests starting to move the needle on certain issues, particularly when it comes to the main thrust of these protests, which is police brutality. And we are seeing some change at the policy level. How is the state of Alabama managing the protests? Are there limits on protesting in certain parts of the state? What's the police presence been like so far?
You know, it's really interesting because given the fight for political power that really took place on the grounds of, in the sites and places of my district, Alabama, Birmingham, Montgomery, Selma, we currently have African-American mayors of the city of Birmingham and the city of Montgomery. And, you know, the protests for the most part have been quite peaceful. We did have an incident that required the African-American mayor of Birmingham to institute curfew, as did across the state, others instituted curfews. And so, but since then, that was about 7 days ago, all the protests have been pretty peaceful. And the reality is that we're seeing generations, it's intergenerational. You're seeing young and old, and you're seeing black and white, and it's a rainbow coalition of a tapestry that's beautifully reflective of the American diversity. And, you know, you're seeing protests in suburbs of Alabama, like Mountain Brook, with 300, you know, white kids, young and old, protesting. And so I think that we are at an inflection point, and we hear that a lot, but I do believe that this moment is different. The angst and the pains of watching another unarmed black man who is handcuffed with someone's knee to his neck just has really inflamed the emotions and caught and ignited the emotions of the world. And I think now is a time for us to change. And I truly hope, as a member of Congress, you know, all of us have a role to play. Our role is to see what we can do in the federal realm to change laws. And I get that laws don't necessarily change hearts, but it can change someone's mind if it's illegal to have a chokehold, or if no-knock warrants are banned, that people will think twice because these are illegal measures. So I just think that we are at a critical point, and I just pray that we come together, Republicans and Democrats, and truly hear and see the cries of America that change is afoot when it comes to police accountability.
We're talking about police accountability. As I mentioned, and I'm sure as you know, we're already seeing change at the local level. At the federal level, however, there is the Justice and Policing Act of 2020. You are one of the many co-sponsors of that act. Tell us the crux of what this act is intended to do from a federal level, and what is it supposed to fix?
It seeks to hold the police accountable by making sure that we work to end racial and religious profiling. It prohibits state, federal, and local law enforcement from racial profiling. It saves lives by banning chokeholds and no-knock warrants. Our realm is within federal law, but by leading by example in the federal government, by making sure that that our federal funding will be conditioned upon states and local governments banning chokeholds and banning no-knock entry or warrants that are required. It also would limit military equipment on American streets and require body cameras. It will hold police accountable in the court system by making sure that we change the standard that's required from one of willfulness to recklessness when it comes to prosecuting officers for federal criminal statutes to prosecute misconduct by the police. It will also provide a registry so that we actually can collect the data to know who are the bad actors and make sure that we are creating a nationwide police misconduct registry to prevent problematic officers who are fired or leave one jurisdiction from moving from jurisdiction to jurisdiction without accountability. It mandates state and local government law enforcement agencies to report the use of force data and disaggregate it by race and sex and disability, age, and religion. It also would make lynching a federal crime. It's also about empowering our communities. I was very happy that we worked so hard to put in the bill grants to communities who to support critical community-based programs that will change will seek to change the culture of law enforcement and empower communities to reimagine public safety in an equitable and just way.
Congresswoman, I want to ask you, because this is a really comprehensive list of things that activists in particular and criminal justice reform activists and advocates have been asking for quite some time. All of the things you listed are basically a checklist of how from the activist perspective, at least, to reform and improve policing. Curious about whether this is, given the moment and given the checklist that you just described, is there bipartisan support for this? And are there any other things that, in order to get bipartisan support, will have to be left out of the bill going forward?
So we're seeking bipartisan support. I believe that the cries of the American people on the streets all across this nation, from big cities to small towns, people are crying out for transformational change in our policing. And this bill, Justice and Policing, does that. And while we have over 200 sponsors right now, and they're all Democrats, I am encouraged by the fact that I hear senators, Republican senators, talk about banning chokeholds, banning no warrant entries, and I do believe that that they all see the need that we have common ground, that we can find some common ground in legislation to move the needle forward. I even see hope in Republicans thinking about doing away with qualified immunity, which is really important as well. So I think that what's going to have to happen is that we're day 18 of protests in the streets, and they're not abating, right? We're seeing more and more people feel galvanized and empowered. And this is what democracy looks like. Democracy, power demands, power concedes nothing without a demand. And what we see on the streets of America right now it was true in 1850 when Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand, never has, never will. And it's true today. And what they're demanding is change. And I do believe that we will find some bipartisan common ground. I believe that the Justice in Policing Act is that common ground. As you rightfully said, this has included a checklist of what criminal justice activists, law enforcement groups have been demanding for the longest. You know, it's true that the majority of law enforcement officers are good, but good cops and good sheriffs want accountability, welcome accountability and transparency. And so I think that we have got to find common ground. As I was saying to my niece, who told me that it's her generation's turn to be heard. They want us to not only see them, but to hear them. And I told her, I'm listening, but it's all about action. We want to make sure that the righteous indignation and anger that we're seeing on the streets of America bore out positive change. Otherwise, I'm so afraid that we'll lose a whole generation of activists who need to see that civic engagement, protesting, voting matters, and that we are hearing them and that we're doing something about it.
You mentioned earlier when we talked about those protests in Alabama, how they are reflective of a new moment in this society, particularly when it comes to who's participating. So there's a multiracial coalition. You called it the Rainbow Coalition. I recall that Jesse Jackson talking about that vision back in the 1980s. And it feels like, you know, we're steps closer to that, at least in terms of who's on the ground. And yet these protests are happening, Congresswoman, with the backdrop, at least in Alabama, of holidays that celebrate people like Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee. How does Alabama right now reconcile celebrating Jefferson Davis, celebrating Robert E. Lee with public holidays, and this moment where people are calling for change, not just at the very top, but also in the very symbols that we see around us every day?
You're absolutely right. You can't say, do you see me? And then have these symbols, and there are over 1,000 Confederate symbols across this nation. And the state of Alabama, as you said, I've called for them to stop celebrating as a state holiday Jefferson Davis's birthday, Robert E. Lee's birthday, veterans of the Confederacy. Those are three holidays. I mean, it's a no-brainer. What you see on the streets of America are people crying out to be seen. And if you see me, then you can't, you cannot continue to have these paying honor and homage to oppressors, people who oppressed me and people who look like me. You know, in Alabama, we saw a mayor in the city of Birmingham take down a monument. We saw a white mayor in Mobile take down a monument. And yet the attorney general of the state of Alabama, because we have a law on the books that you can't take down the Confederate monuments without the approval of the state legislature, the onus is really going to be on the state of Alabama to literally, at this moment in history, live up to the creed of justice for all and do the right thing. The very least to me is to see me and to acknowledge my pain and to take down these monuments and to do away with these holidays. There are people who claim that these monuments honor history and Southern culture, but we have to be clear-eyed about why these monuments and holidays are so horrific to African Americans. Historically, these monuments saw spikes of activity from the 1890s to the 1920s when civil rights leaders were fighting for long-delayed justice for African Americans, and still they persist and the laws still protect them. And I think now, these are low-hanging fruit. This is a no-brainer, in my opinion. Will it change things when it comes to systemic racism? No, but it is the start of a conversation. It is an acknowledgement that, in fact, you do hear me, you do see me, and you do hear my pain.
Congresswoman, you mentioned systemic racism, and it's something that I, frankly, I'm surprised that that phrase is being used by so many people, both in the media, who may never have experienced or really understood systemic racism. One of the ways, as you know, that systemic racism plays out is at the polls, is when in voter suppression, and Alabama has had its own history with voter suppression and concerns about where that is playing out. We know, and we've been discussing on this show, that there's a big issue in Georgia. What are some of the issues that Alabama is afraid of right now when it comes to making sure, or concerned about, I should say, when it comes to making sure that residents of Alabama, black, white, poor, rich, will all be able to cast a ballot come November?
Yes, I think that what we witnessed this past Tuesday in the states that were holding primaries, especially in Georgia, with long lines, is just, to me, emblematic of the fact that we do need to fully restore the Voting Rights Act of 1965. You know, I not only represent Selma, I am a daughter of Selma. I am a lifetime member of Brown Chapel AME Church, where Martin Luther King led the protests in 1965 for the right to vote. And what we saw in Georgia is a direct reflection of the fact that the Shelby versus Holder gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965. We saw long lines. We saw polling stations that were closed because ostensibly for COVID-19. But we also saw inexperienced poll workers there. And we have got to do something right now to make sure that we're protecting the constitutional right for every American to be able to vote. Long lines wrapped around the corner, polling stations not being able to open on time because of new machinery. It's inexcusable. These are modern day barriers to voting. You may not have to count how many marbles are in a jar anymore, but when you have, you know, systematic efforts to make it harder to vote, these are modern day barriers, be it long lines at the polls, be it photo ID laws that prefer gun registration IDs as a form of a legitimate form of a photo ID, your fishing license or your gun license, and not your student license at the University of Alabama. Unacceptable. And so we really need to push back. And I do believe that what you see on the streets of America right now is truly, the call to action was the death of George Floyd. And but we know that we've seen this happen time and time again. And we, while We need to focus on policing and police accountability, which was the impetus for the protests. Systemic racism is ultimately the root, and it is seen in everything we do, from housing to education to the criminal justice system. It means that in America, we have never really reckoned with 400 years of slavery. And there's a wonderful museum that Brian Stevenson and the Equal Justice Initiative did in Alabama. And it's about reconciliation. It's lynching, but it's really about America coming to grips with its own racism that really permeates every part of our society. That's what systemic racism is. It's structural institutional racism that exists in America. And to say that one is colorblind is really a myth.
And to sort of close here, I mean, one of the things that I think, you know, we're discussing racism and systemic racism and police reform, and yet, you know, I say the media has almost taken its eye off a little bit of the back and forth in Washington, right, between the Democrats and Republicans. This is one of the most divided houses and divided governments I think most of us have seen in our lifetime. When we look at Alabama, Congresswoman, what is the future of the Democratic Party in Alabama? You are the only Democrat representing the state in the U.S. House. So where does the Democratic Party go from here in Alabama?
Well, listen, I think that for all of my state's faults, I do believe that it is a state that is filled with people of goodwill who really do want to try to do the right thing. And while I may be the only member of the House of Representatives, the fact that we were able to elect Doug Jones to the United States Senate from the state of Alabama, and we did so electing a Democrat in a state where the Alabama Democratic Party has really been diminishing over the years. I'm excited about our new state chair. We have Chris England, State Representative Chris England is the first African-American to actually be ahead of the state party in the state of Alabama. He's doing an incredible job in bringing a whole new generation of Alabamians, black and white, people of color, a true tapestry rainbow coalition into the Alabama Democratic Party. And I am hopeful. I have to be hopeful. I want to be the change that I want to see in my state and in my nation. And collectively, this is our watch. I get that I am a member of Congress, but all of us are seeing this and all of us have a role to play. And I just really, I really ask your listening audience, we have to all just reflect and decide, how can we make a difference? It's one thing to ask your black friends how they're doing, but the reality is this is collectively all of our watch and we all have a role to play. What are we willing to do to see a better America, to see an America that truly is inclusive? Inequities in race exist in every part of our society. And so we all have a part to do in order to make this this nation a more perfect union.
Congresswoman Terry Sewell represents the 7th Congressional District of Alabama. Representative Sewell, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
When talking about police brutality against black men and women, there's one thing that often gets lost in the conversation, and that's disability. Victims of police brutality, including Freddie Gray, Keith Lamont Scott, and Tanisha Anderson, were all black, were all killed by police, and each had a disability. And as police violence against black people continues to be in the national spotlight, the reality of police violence against disabled people, especially disabled people of color, is often less discussed. And while there's no federal data on police violence against people with disabilities, experts estimate that around 30 to 50% of people killed by police also have a disability. To understand how police violence affects the black disabled community, I spoke with Haben Girma, a disability rights advocate and author of Haben, The Deaf-Blind Woman Who Conquered Harvard Law.
There are so many black disabled lives that have been lost to police violence. Eric Smith is an example from Chicago. He was 22, an honor student, and deaf. He was on the side of the road talking with his grandmother. He was deaf and signing. So physical gestures, the police described him as a large black man. They assumed he was a threat. They shouted orders. He could not hear the orders. It's not his fault. deafness wasn't the problem here. The problem was the police's assumptions. They saw a black man, shouted commands, he didn't respond. They killed him. And this is not an isolated story. There are many, many stories like this. So when we talk about police violence, we need to also talk about disabled black people and the intersections of ableism and racism. Racism causes many officers to see black and brown people as a threat. And when we don't comply because we didn't hear the command, or we can't move in a certain way, or we don't see a physical gesture, or maybe there's an invisible disability like a psychiatric disability, then the non-compliance is interpreted as threatening. And that's the cause of a lot of the violence against black and brown people, an intersection of racism and ableism. And any solutions to police brutality against black people need to also address ableism.
Haben, have you wanted to protest these past weeks, and have you been able to?
I want people to expand the definition of protest. Right now, the definition of protest is very able-bodied. It's a physical standing up in the street, holding signs. There are many different ways to protest. There are disabled people who are protesting in the streets using wheelchairs or other assistive devices. There are disabled people protesting from home through social media, through calls to their representatives. So we should expand the definition of protest. We also need to make sure the physical and digital protests are accessible. Content online needs to have captions, sign language interpreters, and images need to also include image descriptions. So if you post a photo, a chart, a flyer, include text describing what's in that chart, image, or flyer so blind people can also access it, participate in the movement, join the protests. Digital and physical protest needs to be accessible.
We're also in the middle of a global pandemic, which is affecting black people at higher rates than it is white people in many parts of the country. Haben, did you feel like you got the support that you needed to be able to ride out stay-at-home orders or the pandemic more broadly?
I'm blessed to have a safe, accessible home. If a situation arose where I needed to go to the hospital, I'm deeply concerned that I would be denied communication access. A lot of hospitals are isolating people with COVID-19. I need communication access. I'm deafblind. I'm engaging with you right now by an assistant typing on a keyboard, and I'm reading in Braille. I'm concerned they would not allow me to have an interpreter at the hospital. And then how would I know what health options I had? Would I get the care I need? And a lot of disabled people around the United States are also concerned about not getting cared or already being denied care.
We're also joined now by Velisa Thompson, a social worker and disability rights activist. Velisa, what about you in this pandemic? It's been difficult for able-bodied people to get things like groceries or just, you know, be able to survive in many ways. How did you feel you were supported or not supported during the peak of the pandemic?
You know, luckily I have community here that if I need assistance, I gain it. But if I was to get the virus, my main concern would be who would advocate for me, you know, as a social worker. I know I have a robust, you know, network of other social workers who I know would, but it makes me fearful about what kind of care would I receive in a hospital setting, even with my own professional background, because I know that does not protect me from medicalized racism, ableism, and so forth. So for me, I worry about the kind of care I would get. I worry about if my quality of life would be respected, if doctors would feel the need to do all the means necessary to keep me alive, or would they see me as a burden and devalue my life so that I would not be getting the necessary supports needed to live or to get well. So for me, it's all about depending on who I encounter at the hospital and how they view me, that will greatly determine not only the quality of care, but possibly me having my life. And even though I know how to advocate for myself from being an activist and being a social worker, I know those means are still not enough, particularly when you are isolated in the cases of contracting the virus and having to figure out what's going on, which can be very scary as someone who has surgeries. And even though I've been with family during that time, I cannot even imagine being alone in the hospital and not having anyone to be by my side to advocate for me, to understand what's going on in case I'm not able to. So those are real fears that I and many other people in the community have right now. You know, if we do get sick, who's going to be there? What quality of care we're going to receive? All those things run through my mind. You know, as we have been through the peak and, you know, with reports of a possible second peak coming.
Velissa, what do you think police departments can do better in terms of dealing with Black people with disabilities? Haven mentioned a couple of examples of things they can improve on. What do you think?
Personally, I don't think that they're willing to do anything to improve because they've received the adequate training over the past several years, and we're still dying at the hands of the police. So for me, particularly as a social worker, knowing that there are people within my profession, within these departments, I am seeing that there is no type of training or educating the police to stop them killing Black disabled folks and other disabled people of color. This is what they want to do. This is the culture that has been cultivated since the enactment of the police in this country. So I think that we need to face the music that nothing will keep the police from killing us because they don't care about not killing us.
Velissa Thompson is a social worker and disability rights activist. Velissa, thank you.
Thank you.
And Haben Girma is a disability rights advocate and author. Haben, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, we had a very heavy show today, but we appreciate you being here with us and working through these issues every day. And we'd like to hear from you and how you're reflecting on this moment in the news. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. You can follow me at Tanzina Vega. And we'll be back with you tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.